APAMADA's programmes and facilities are supported through your generosity. Your support really does make a huge difference. You'll find a link for contributions on the website at apamada.org/contribute. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Buddhas.
Good morning,
Buddhas online. I have a poem to share with you. I said to Flint, this talk is either 6 hours or 7 minutes, and I can't. So, anyway, I thought I would share this poem, which is by Wei Nung, one of our sixth Zen ancestor. And the origin of the Platform Sutra. Deluded, a Buddha is a sentient being. Awakened, a sentient being is a Buddha. Ignorant, a Buddha is a sentient being. With wisdom, a sentient being is a Buddha. If the mind is warped, a Buddha is a sentient being. If the mind is impartial, a sentient being is a Buddha. When once a warped mind is produced, Buddha is concealed within the sentient being. If for one instant of thought we become impartial, then sentient beings are themselves Buddha. In our mind itself, a Buddha exists. Our own Buddha is the true Buddha. If we do not have in ourselves the Buddha mind, then where are we to seek Buddha? So I was thinking about our exercise last night, and that poem came to me. Poems are gifts. It's just so wonderful that we have them. So today, I want to talk about the part of the Fukan Zazengi where the actual Zazen instructions are given. So I'm going to remind you what those instructions are. For Sanzen, a quiet room is suitable. Eat and drink moderately. Cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros or cons. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. Sanzen has nothing whatever to do with sitting or lying down. And yet, at the side of your regular sitting, spread out thick matting and place a cushion above it. Sit either in the full lotus or half lotus position. In the full lotus position, you first place your right foot on your left thigh and your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, you simply press your left foot against your right thigh. You should have your robes and belt loosely bound and arranged in order. Then place your right hand on your left leg and your left palm facing upwards on your right palm, thumb tips touching. Thus sit upright in correct bodily posture, neither inclining to the left nor to the right, neither leaning forward nor backward. Be sure your ears are on a plane with your shoulders and your nose in line with your navel. Place your tongue against the front roof of your mouth with teeth and lips both shut. Your eyes should always remain open, and you should breathe gently through your nose. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale and exhale, rock your body right and left, and settle into a steady, immobile sitting position. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. The Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the manifestation of ultimate reality. Traps and snares can never reach it. Once its heart is grasped, you are like the dragon when he gains the water, like the tiger when she enters the mountain. For you must know that just there, in Zazen, the right Dharma is manifesting itself, and that from the first, dullness and distraction are struck aside. When you arise from sitting, move slowly and quietly, calmly and deliberately. Do not rise suddenly or abruptly. In surveying the past, we find the transcendence of both unenlightenment and enlightenment, and dying while either sitting or standing have all depended entirely on the strength of Zazen. In addition, the bringing about of enlightenment by the opportunity provided by a finger, a banner, a needle, or a mallet, and the effecting of realization with the aid of a hasu, a fist, a staff, or a shout, cannot be fully understood by discriminative thinking. Indeed, it cannot fully be known by the practicing or realizing of supernatural powers either. It must be deportment beyond hearing and seeing. Is it not a principle that is prior to knowledge and perceptions? So the fundamental Buddha principle. So I was really interested in this because of the concrete particulars. And when we do orientation, we don't go into quite the details of where to put your tongue, your lips, you know, so forth. So, but all great poetry is this particular, is this specific. It's in the concrete details. And so maybe you noticed this morning when you were sitting a little bit differently because we have this instruction, right? And we can return to it as a way of sort of orienting ourselves and returning to our intention. So, and it's comprehensive. So Dogen takes the ecological view. Let's talk first about the environment. A quiet room is suitable, right? Then we're going to talk about the body. So eat and drink moderately. Why? Because if you're hungry, you're going to be thinking about food. And if you're stuffed, you're going to be sleepy. So eat and drink moderately. And what are we going to do with this mind, you know? Cast aside all involvements and cease all affairs. Well, we're constantly working our to-do list or shopping list or, you know, grievances and so forth. And so just cast that aside. Do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. This is so easy, right? Just don't do that. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. Well, okay. We have to disentangle ourselves somehow from our usual busyness and opinions. But mostly, that's what we notice when we get quiet and when we sit still. So, moreover, have no designs on becoming a Buddha. Well, what? You know, like, why are we doing this then? That was the fundamental question that Dogen was asking, right? Isn't this what we're sitting for? Isn't that sort of the goal? I mean, do we just want to be the same stupid people we already are? So, we've already talked about this, right? We've already experienced and recognizing each other as already Buddha, right? Last night, we had a little taste of that, a little glimpse. We sit because that's what Buddhas do. We sit to recall who we really are. It's all about that recollection. Oh, that's right. You know, I've been fuming in the traffic instead of realizing who I really am. Then we get this cryptic note, Sanzen has nothing whatever to do with sitting or lying down, despite the fact that I'm going to give you all these instructions that are specifically about sitting. So is that a big contradiction? Is Dogen contradicting himself? Like, it has nothing to do with sitting or lying down, and yet I'm now about to give you very precise instructions for sitting. And I think what is clear to me is there isn't really a contradiction. Ultimately, that quality of mind that we cultivate in Zazen is not limited to sitting, walking, standing, lying down. But eventually, we have access to that in every aspect of our lives. But to discover that, we need some scaffolding. We need some support to do that. And to do that, we're going to now tell you exactly what to do with your body, exactly what to do with your lips, exactly what to do with your teeth, and exactly what to do particularly with your mudra, right? Place your right hand on your left and your left palm facing upwards, your right palm, thumbs, tips touching. And we typically give the instruction as though a piece of paper could be drawn through those thumbs, right? So they're not mashed together and they're also not falling apart. And this is a wonderful little grounding piece of mindfulness you can do in the middle of zazen. Are my fingers like this? Are my thumb, well, you know, where are my thumbs? Are they mashed up into a mountain? Are they falling into some kind of a valley? So, so this holds so much of the presence of mind, the quality of mind that we bring into our zazen, and not leaning, right? We don't want to be leaning to the left or to the right, regardless of your political views. You don't want to be leaning to the left or to the right in zazen. You want to be upright. So, yeah, place your tongue against the front roof of your mouth with lips and teeth both shut. So, not clenched together, just closed. And this, again, focuses our intention and our attention. So what do we do with our eyes? Your eyes should always remain open. So this is across, you know, Buddhist schools is quite different. In some places, you sit with your eyes closed, some traditions. Some traditions, you sit with your eyes open. So in, for example, in the Tibetan tradition, your eyes are wide open. But we want this relaxed, sort of unfocused gaze that is just at ease. Everything is at ease. Breathing, breathe gently through your nose. And then we're going to attain to this immobile position. So it's really challenging, especially early in practice, because we have itches, we have aches, we have, you know, like just these little subtle ways, we, you know, sometimes not so subtle when you're just starting out, like, of trying to get comfortable, you know, in what is essentially a very unfamiliar position. And so to recognize, oh, the goal is not a certain rigid posture. The goal is to allow yourself to sit in a way that immobilizes you, that makes you still, because every movement is jerking the mind around. Think, well, okay, think, not thinking. But, you know, like, so a lot of us struggle with that, trying to wrestle our minds into some kind of submission, you know, like, I'm supposed to be not thinking. And our primary question people get in teaching is, how do I stop my mind from thinking? You know, my mind is constantly thinking. We have all this distraction. And what Dogen's pointing to is something prior to thinking. And that sense of non-thinking is, what is it that precedes the thought? So sometimes when I would have a thought, I would think, what just preceded this thought? You know, what came before this thought? A little bit of physical discomfort, or, you know, another idea, one idea leading to another. And I started to see, oh, if you go back to the origin, this is the non-thinking, right? Out of which all of this is proliferating. So then he gives a brief advertisement.
Didn't someone say to Joko, what do you do when you're sitting?
Yeah. Yeah, her senior student, Elizabeth, said to Joko, what do you do when you're with your mind when you're sitting? And Joko said, mostly thinking.
Thinking about things.
Yeah. Because that's what minds do, you know, like, that's what they do.
What's the space, though?
Yeah, what's the space? And it's really this recalling. Like, a lot of the thoughts that I have are not thoughts that a Buddha has. That's what I have
they
to
do.
That's what apparently they do. So then, Dogen's going to give an ad for meditation in which he says, the zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. And this is where you find yourself with the non-thinking, right? You find yourself immersed in repose and bliss. That quality of nothing else is needed now. I'm completely content right where I am right now. So the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. There's nothing more you need to do. You're already there. So it's the manifestation of ultimate reality. Traps and snares can never reach it. So what are the traps and snares? What do you think?
Judgment.
Judgment.
Conditions.
Thoughts. Yeah. Opinions. Views.
Planning.
Planning.
Planning. Yeah. List making. Yeah, and also this thought, I must not be doing this right somehow, because I don't feel like I'm very enlightened. So once its heart is grasped, this is like this sense the heart of it is grasped, you know, like that's a very, I think, energetic phrase to use. Once its heart is grasped, like you have to be fierce about your zazen. You have to be fierce about this. You're like the dragon when he gains the water, like the tiger when she enters the mountain, like at home, totally at home. For you must know that just there in zazen, the right dharma is manifesting itself, and that from the first, dullness and distraction are struck aside. So everybody's had the experience of being completely transfixed by a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise, right? And no matter what state your body or mind is in, you're completely, I think, enchanted, I would say. And dullness and distraction, where are they? They're not there, right? You're completely there. Maybe you're looking into the eyes of your little granddaughter, or, you know, just that moment where you're taken completely out of this everyday preoccupation that we're meshed in. And then, you know, he even talks about arising after zazen, which is interesting to me because in the Rinzai tradition, you bolt up, you know, you're supposed to be vigorous and show energy, you know? So if they announce that the, you know, the teacher's available for Dokusan, everybody leaps up and runs to the door, you know, trampling small children and old men. Supposed to show how vigorous you are, you know? Dogen's like, nope, rise slowly, quietly. You've established a certain quality of mind, a certain presence of mind. You don't want to immediately scatter it in a million directions, right? We take our time. So these instructions are very specific, very complete, and Dogen presents them, even though he didn't write them, right? They originated somewhere else with this earlier Chinese Chan teachings. And so a lot is made of the fact that he basically just dropped this chunk of text in there. But I understood this a little differently because I worked with many Asian students when I was teaching writing at UC San Diego. And they all did this without exception. They had no concept of plagiarism. And so I had to talk to my sister who lived in Japan for years about this. I said to her, they don't cite any sources. They just drop a chunk of text in that they've taken out of one of the things they're reading. And she said, in Japan, if someone has said something well, that just goes in because they've said it better than you can. So here, you know, or this is as well as it can be said. So it just gets dropped in. And in that sense, you know, all of the texts are actually communal texts. And so many of the things that we read, the teachings of people like Keizan or Hakuin or any of the early in, they've just dropped in things they've heard or read somewhere right into their text. Many, many allusions to the Lotus Sutra in Dogen, no footnotes, no citations, you know, that's not the way it was done. So I have a kind of fondness for the fact that Dogen was taught this, and he thought, this is the best way to explain this to people. I'm putting it right here in my universal recommendations for zazen. So, but we have, you know, we have the concept of individual ownership of language. Like, you can own language, right? In the same way that we have the concept that you can own land, right? Which the Native Americans did not have that concept. So it's a kind of a different enterprise in a way. It's like collective wisdom is the important thing, not that you get credit for something that you said very, very well. It's very different, right? It's a different mindset. Okay, then he goes on. Now, this is really interesting to me because here's this list, in addition, the bringing about of enlightenment by the opportunity provided by a finger, a banner, a needle, or a mallet. We're waiting for our teachers to bring those things out, right? and the effecting of realization with the aid of a hasu, a fist, a staff, or a shout. So the items in this list, so I encountered this book by Philippe Coupe. You know him?
Yes.
Disciple of Deshi Maharaj.
Well, actually, he's an American. He's from New York, and he's a teacher at Dojo Zen de Paris. So
yes.
Yes, I've been sitting
yeah.
when he was reading this.
Well, he has a wonderful book about the Fukan Zazengi. So I'll draw a little bit on that. He says the items in this list refer to specific stories in Buddhist history, most of which we've encountered. And they can be found in the Mumonkan and the Hakigan Roku, which show masters going beyond words to express the vastness of the teaching. Here, Dogen seems to be in favor of these different methods used to awaken disciples, but later he would criticize this sort of Zen education, which is particularly associated with the Rinzai school. So later he became disenchanted. But he felt, so the story of the finger is a nun once asked Gute, what is the essence of Buddhism? He didn't know what to say, and the nun went away quite disappointed. Later, when the master, Tenryu, visited him, Gute asked him the same question. What is the essence of Buddhism? Tenryu silently held up his thumb. Gute had Satori. He understood that the essence of Zen was beyond words. Later, Gute became famous for teaching with his thumb. That's all he ever did. When he couldn't answer a question with words, what is ku, what is mu, what is Satori, he would hold up his thumb. So he had a boy attendant who began to imitate him. Follow the teacher, right? Whenever a visitor asked what his master had taught that day, the boy raised his thumb. Gute heard about this, seized the boy, and cut off his thumb with a knife. This is not a pedagogical method we use. As the boy ran screaming from the room, Gute called out to him. And when the boy stopped and turned, Gute held up his thumb. And in that moment, the boy had Satori. So, again, not a pedagogical method that we use, but
stories like that.
Stories like that. And I had a Chinese Chan graduate student tell me, you know, when Chan became Zen in Japan, they dropped all the violence out of it. It became nonviolent. It was never nonviolent in China. So the banner is the story. He says some translations of the Fukan Zazenge use the word pole instead of flag. It said that Ananda, the second Buddhist patriarch, realized the truth when he saw and heard a pole fall at a temple. Master Sakiso said, you are at the top of a 100-foot pole. Now you must take another step. So there's also the story of the two monks arguing over whether a flag was moving, a banner was moving, or whether the mind, or whether the wind was moving. And the master comes by and says, mind moves. Mind moves.
Mind what?
Mind moves.
Mind moves.
The story of the needle is Buddha's disciple Aniruddha was always falling asleep when Buddha was teaching. Hard to imagine. Appalled by his own laziness, he vowed never to sleep again and began working day and night without rest. Buddha told him several times that while a monk should not be lazy, working excessively without rest was also an error. Aniruddha replied, I cannot forget the vow I made. Eventually, he went blind. One day, he was trying hard to mend his kesa, but could not thread the needle himself. The Buddha heard about this and came to see him in his hut. Aniruddha, he said from the doorway, give me your needle and thread and I will mend your robe. The old monk recognized his master's voice and asked, you've practiced compassion and good deeds for so long. Why have you come to help me thread the needle? The Buddha told him, like you, I cannot forget the vow I made. The story of the mallet is the story of Kyozan, who dreamed he went to Maitreya's Pure Land and sat in the third seat. A monk there struck the wood with a mallet, like we have the clappers, struck the wood with a mallet, and said, today, the one in the third seat will give a sermon. Kyozan arose. Could happen to you. Kyosan arose, also struck the wood with a mallet, and said, the truth of Mahayana is beyond any verbal expression. Listen, listen. The story of the hasu, you probably don't know what a hasu is. You maybe have never even seen one. It's a staff with a horsehair end to it.
A whisk.
Yeah, it's a whisk. And originally was used to keep flies off, you know. And so the attendant would use it to keep the flies off the master while the master was giving a talk. So in our lineage, the master carries a hasu during the ordination ceremony and it's gifted to someone who is receiving Dharma transmission. And that's not to be confused with the kotsu, which is the stick with the little curl on it. So Baso asked his disciple Hyakujo, "How would you teach others?" Hyakujo raised his hosu. Baso said, "Is that all? No other way?" Hyakujo threw the hosu down. So that was his response. So that's that story. So all of these are stories that provoked some enlightenment, right? By some external means, nonverbal means. The fist, Rinzai had been following Master Obaku's teaching for 3 years, but he had never asked him a question. One day, Obaku's Shuso encouraged Rinzai to go and ask something of the master. Ask him, "What is the essence of Buddhism?" he suggested. Rinzai did as he was told, but Obaku merely whacked him repeatedly with the kyosaku, which is the long staff they use to wake up people when they're sitting. After the third time, Rinzai had had enough. He asked if he could leave for a while. The Shuso gave him permission, but said that he must be sure to visit Master Taigu, whose name means great fool. "Why are you here?" Taigu asked Rinzai when he showed up. Rinzai explained all that had happened and finished by asking, "So please tell me, what is the essence of Buddhism?" Obaku has treated you with grandmotherly kindness," answered Taigu. "He gave you the exact answer to your question. You're foolish and your head is thick." Rinzai had Satori at that moment. Taigu told him to return to Obaku, which he did. He went directly to the master's room. "Well," said Obaku, "look who's back. Do you understand the essence of Buddhism now?" "Yes, I understand it completely," said Rinzai, and punched Obaku. "Go back to the dojo," said Obaku, "and next time be careful not to touch the tiger's whiskers." The story of the staff. This is surely a reference to that kyosaku, same kyosaku, long staff, which unfortunately we've abandoned the use of, although it's so incredibly useful.
It is.
Yeah.
It was actually part of our training, and we used it, I think, appropriately and only with invitation. It was really useful.
It was really useful. Because when you're sitting long session, you get tightness right here, right? And you don't even really realize it exactly. But then along comes whoever's wielding the kyosaku. And it's very formal. It's a ceremony, you know. They pass behind you, you raise your hands. Although in earlier days, they didn't even raise their hands. They just got it without warning. But then you get this whack on the shoulders.
Lean over a little bit.
Lean over a little bit. Catches you right on that muscle. And all of that, it's like electric. It's like electricity going through your body. And then all of that relaxes.
Acupressure.
Yeah. It's very, very effective. But we had to stop doing it because so many people have traumatic experiences around being hit.
And it sounds terrible.
And it sounds terrible. But it does wake everyone in the room up.
It feels really good.
Yeah. But it is not, it's not really painful. But for some people, even witnessing that for someone else is very triggering. So it's still used in some places, but not generally in this country. And as far as the shout goes, Baso was known for shouting. One day he screamed so loudly that his disciple Hyakujo was deaf for several days. Master Rinzai was also famous for his shouting. Usually a monk would ask, "What is the essence of Buddhism?" And Rinzai would scream, "What?" It's no particular meaning. Then the monk would bow and gosho. "Thank you for your teaching." So that's what that list is, in case you were wondering. It's a specific list. It's not just a bunch of things. It's a specific list that refers, and that anyone hearing this text would recall those stories that they've been told. So then Dogen makes clear that it can't even be discovered by discriminative thinking, can't be known by the practicing or realizing of supernatural powers. So the writer Charles Bukowski once said, "If you can't say it with words, it's because what you have to say is invalid." It's a typical poet's thing to say. But Kauti says, This is not really the Zen approach. Shouts and blows were meant to shake up the mind and push it out of its dualistic thinking. If you're focused on your ego, you're automatically in a dualistic state of mind. And words are often a trap that keep us in duality. However, we shouldn't think that words are an obstacle to Satori or that awakening happens in Zazen. Joko told me about a big awakening she had at a stoplight. She was driving. And about the supernatural powers, it's understood that supernatural powers are kind of personal magic, you know, like they do exist. So, and you can read about these accounts, even by observers, of supernatural powers being manifested. But they are our personal problems, you know? This is something I have, and this power to walk through walls, or this power to, and Joko talked about this. She said, I used to have sort of the useful capacity to know what was cooking in the dining hall next door. And that way I would know whether to go for the meal or not. Like, it's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, it's a very personal thing. It's not anything in the service of vow, right? So it's not really our part of our. So Kofi says, no supernatural power will help us to understand the awakening that may be caused by a raised thumb or a hasu. No supernatural power will help us to understand Bodhisattva, the mind that sees the impermanence of the world, the impermanence of birth and death. The power of Zazen here and now is natural, and through that natural power, we can see our real nature, which no supernatural power can show us. Supernatural powers do exist. It is possible, through constant practice, to see the past and the future, to bring forth demons, ghosts, or spirits, and make them visible. Through rigorous training, day after day and year after year, with a view towards developing supernatural powers, consciousness grows to a point where one can see what was hidden. There is a practice called Nenjutsu, based on correct breathing, which allows one to become invisible at will. These things are only magic powers, and the people who practice them do not abandon their false ideas and delusions. Their supernatural accomplishments don't help them to enter the way of awakening, the way of the Buddhas, the way of great freedom. We don't teach these supernatural practices in our Sangha. Real magic begins with the natural power and energy of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So sometimes you read these mystic accounts and it seems so compelling, you know, like wouldn't it be wonderful to become invisible in the middle of a family gathering? That would be a nice supernatural power to have. Sometimes we think, you know. So here, right here, in this little section, Dogen is really talking about Zazen practice at the individual level. Anyone can go out and practice this, right, in your home or anywhere. This is about this personal form. So from here, we move outward, right? And we'll be talking more about forms and about the way that forms help us be together, not just sit in Zazen and cultivate this Buddha nature, but also the way that we come together and the way the forms help us as an expression of our vow. So I just want to say that the forms are not only containers for practice, they're not only opportunities to observe our own conditioning, not only useful mindfulness practice opportunities, they're expressions of our care and support for one another. And that we'll talk a little bit more about as we go through this week. So I hope that's a little bit helpful. Is probably enough for one morning, right? But I like this close attention to the text because it opens things up for me, you know, and I start to think, oh, I just thought this, like, oh, just sit down, you know, like, just, you know, and then there's many, many instructions. But when I start to look at it, I see how much care Dogen was manifesting for his students, how much he wanted them to understand the quality of attention and intention we bring, the care we bring to every aspect of our practice, beginning with this personal individual form of sitting in Zazen. So, all right, that's probably enough for one day.